I'd like to explain to you how this program came to be. And this outfit that I have on does have a meaning. And we start our story off in Williamsburg, Virginia. Several years ago, my wife and I had gone to Williamsburg, Virginia. How many people have been to Williamsburg, Virginia? Well, what a marvelous experience that is, isn't it? For those of you who haven't, just to say something about it, Williamsburg, Virginia is a place that the people are reenacting on a daily basis the events that led up to 1776. They are always in costume. They are always in those years. You cannot say anything to them about TV or airplanes or telephones. They won't know what you're talking about. They stay in character and they're for the era in red coats or the colonial army, what have you. That's the way they dress, that's where they stay. Well, I wasn't dressed like this when I was there, neither was my wife, but I used this to bring back that period. The story begins. One nice summer day, I had on a baseball cap, a backpack, shorts on, and I was eating an ice cream cone. And I was walking down the streets, you can't drive, you walk down the streets in Williamsburg, Virginia. Very curious place, people in red coats and they dress funny. Two or 300 years ago now, it looked very odd. As I walked down eating my ice cream cone and looking at the different things going on, a soldier said to me, he was in colonial uniform, he was standing next to a pup tent. He was standing at attention. The rifle he had was very ragged. I think if he tried to fire it, he would have killed himself. The pup tent that was going to be his home to fight against the British soldiers looked terrible. And inside the pup tent, as I could see, there was straw on the ground, and that would be his bed. And this colonial soldier said to me, "You, sir, we need some more men. Will you join our forces?" I looked at him, at his tent, his rifle, his clothing, that was bad enough. I had this ice cream cone in my hand, and I said, "Let me think about it." He said, "That's right, sir. You think about it. And when they come to your home and they take away your gunpowder, that is very necessary to have, when they begin to put their British red coats, we call them lobsters, into your home, when they begin to chase out your family, and when they begin to force your men onto their ships, you tell me what you thought about." And I tell you, my dear friends, it was the year 1999 that I was there. But when he said that, and I looked at that colonial soldier, I suddenly was back in the year 1776. It was so impressive, and I was so impressed with the idea, here is where our country began. These are the people that are fighting the British soldiers, that are trying to run the British soldiers off the land. I tell you, I wanted to take that ice cream cone and throw it down, take off that baseball cap, throw it away, and put on whatever clothes he had on, and pick up one of those terrible looking rifles and fight the enemies was what to become our country. Well, that was my impression, so I thought about that. I thought also, here's a group of people fighting for their freedom, and yet they have people enslaved. And so I'm one of the slave people, sort of dressed like this. I might be carrying a pouch or maybe a food in here, trying to find out a way that I can escape and that I can become a free man like they're fighting for. They're fighting for freedom. Why can't I fight for freedom? I should be able to do the same thing, but they won't include me in this fight. They want to put me aside. They're going to fight the redcoats. They're going to fight the lobsters all by themselves. I'm not going to be included, even though I live in this country now. I've been brought to this country, but I'm not allowed to fight. I want to fight. They decided not to let me fight. But a strange thing happened. As the British were beginning to fight, they saw all of these enslaved people. The British said, "I know what we will do. We will tell the enslaved people, we tell them, if you come to be on our side, we'll set you free. When the colonial government heard that, they decided we had better enlist the enslaved people, and that's how I would become a soldier. We hear about Paul Revere writing, telling people, the British are coming, the British are coming. We don't hear about the 5,000 black people who also helped in that effort. We don't hear about Peter Salem, who also fired a very important shot in that war. We don't hear about that. And that's sort of what this is about, to whet your appetite to know that there were other people, black people, also fighting. And one of the most important black peoples of that time was Crispus Attucks. Has anybody heard that name before? Crispus Attucks? Before I tell you, let me sing a bit of a song. In 76, the sky was red. The bomb was busting overhead. And old King George couldn't sleep in his bed. And on that stormy morn, old Uncle Sam was born. Old Sam put on a three-cornered hat. Did that all stay up? And in a Richmond church he sat, and Patrick Henry told him that, while America drew breath, it was liberty or death. That song comes from a very important song called Ballad for Americans. Please look up that song. It is sung by Paul Robeson, one of the greatest singers of our time. Well, you're telling me the story. The British were taking over homes, taking over property, taking gunpowder that was so very much needed. And they were commandering men to go into the Navy and to fight for them, to sail for them. And we didn't want to do that, but they forced us to do that. A very important person had made several friends in Boston. But he was somewhat of a fugitive because he was an escaped slave. His name was Crispus Attucks. And so he ran away and he got onto a merchant ship. And he began sailing around the world in many different parts of the world. He saw how freedom could be arranged for his people. In Haiti especially, the people were free and they were educated. They were treated like human beings. But he couldn't stay in Haiti. He wanted to go back to his own country. So he sailed around and he sailed around many years. Finally, he wound up back in Boston. When his ship landed in Boston, his friends came to the ship and said, Crispus, you're back. We need you to help us. He was a big man. He was a strong man. He could lift an ox cart. He was so strong. And we need a leader. We want to fight the redcoats, those lobsters. They're beginning to take our homes and take our gunpowder. Will you lead us? I don't think I want to do that. I just want to do some tanning or something else. But we need you to lead us. I will lead you if you do one thing. Anything you want, Christians. What is that? What can we do? If you would come with me down to that guardhouse there and fight against those soldiers, I would lead you. When he spoke of fighting, he meant to use clubs and rakes. They didn't have really weapons to use, but they're going to threaten those soldiers. And they said that they would follow him. You are our leader. And so they started marching down towards that guardhouse with their rakes. And Crispus was in front, waving a club at the soldiers, telling the redcoats to get off our land. Get off, we don't want you here, to get off our land. Those redcoats, three young men standing there with their rifles, standing at attention. And here comes a crowd of people coming down the street at them, coming from all corners of this town. They don't quite know what to do. But they know they have one set of orders, and that order is you will not fire on the populace until you are given orders to do that. They are standing there, and the people are coming. And Crispus Attucks is in the front of waving his club, and they have the rakes and all kind of things to use. I don't want to say rakes. What do you get the hay with?
Pitchfork.
I knew a lot of farmers in here. Pitchfork, I couldn't think of that. See, that wouldn't happen to the people in 1776. They would think of pitchfork, but anyway, I couldn't think of that. So they have these pitchforks and they're attacking these people. They are told you will not fire. But they begin to get nervous. A group of people coming to them with weapons, they begin to get nervous. You will not fire unless the captain tells you to fire.
and the late man is pissed at it. One of the soldiers becomes very nervous. He lifts his weapon, pow! And he shoots that weapon. And the first martyr to die for our country is a black person, Crispus Attucks. Read the story of Crispus Attucks. After that death, for every year up until 1776, they would have an annual remembrance day for the martyrs. Crispus Attucks and four of his white friends died that day. And there is a monument in Boston to that fact. Crispus Attucks, the first person to die as a martyr for our country, was a black man. You need to know that. This program is another program of the rest of the story that we need to know about. That is the story about Crispus Attucks in part. Another person I'm going to tell you about is Harry Tubman. How many people know the name Harry Tubman? Wonderful. Harry Tubman. When Harry Tubman was a little girl, her father did a wonderful thing with her. He would take her out into the woods and he would show her the different trees. He would teach her how to listen to the birds. He would teach her how to pick berries, what you could eat, what you could not eat. He would tell her that on this side of the tree, when you see more than that side of the tree, that's the north side of the tree. That would help you to go know where the north is. He told her all kinds of things about the forest. Her father's name was Ben, and the owners loved Ben. Ben could go any place on the plantation, and they would let him go. They knew he would come back. But he often took his daughter into the woods with no other purpose than to teach her about the woods. And he taught her about the woods. Well, as Harriet Tubman grew up, when she was about 12 years old, there was a young black boy trying to escape. And he tried to escape. He was running away from his master. The master got so angry, he told Harry, "You grab that boy and you hold him while I get the whip and beat him for trying to run away." And she wouldn't do it. And he sort of ran through a door or space, and she blocked it. And the master couldn't get to that boy. He became so angry, he picked up something like a weight, and he threw it at the boy, I suspect. But he hit Harry in the head. And he put a big dent in her head, and that knocked her unconscious. And she was unconscious for several weeks. Her mother took care of her and took care of her and took care of her until she got her back to health. But she had a big problem. She would often fall asleep, and she wouldn't know that she was falling asleep. She could be playing, she could be doing anything, and she'd just fall asleep. And when she awoke, she wouldn't know that she'd been asleep. She thought about running away when she was a small person or a young person, but she was afraid to do that because she'd be running away and she'd fall asleep and they could bring her back. But as she got bigger and bigger and stronger, she got as strong as probably three or four men. And she decided she's going to run away. She's going to run away because she heard they were going to sell her further south. If they're going to sell her further south, that was sure death. Not only that, they're going to sell her brothers and her father and her mother further south. She knew she had to run away. When to do that? How to do that? If I'm going to run away, I can't tell my mother, she said, because my mother might cry out. If she cries out, then they're going to know I'm trying to escape. I cannot tell her. I will tell my brothers, though. I'm going to escape. Do you want to escape? Will you come with me? Yes. We'll come with you. We have to leave Mama and Daddy behind. God, no, Daddy won't leave Mama. So we have to leave them behind. And you can't tell them. We've got to escape on our own. We'll go with you, Harriet. And they started running to escape. The brothers became a bit afraid, and they went back. But Harriet continued on, and she continued on, and she met people that would help her to escape. It was called the Underground Railroad. She didn't know that name at the time, but they helped her to escape. And then she did escape. And when she got to the land of freedom, she felt very good about herself. She looked at her hands. She smelled the air. And she wondered, am I still the same person?
I feel so free. I feel different. Yes, I'm still the same person, but now I'm free. When I work, I get paid for it. But my family, they are still back there, down there in the South. I've got to go back and get my mother, and get my brothers, and get my father out of there. How am I going to do that? She met some people who are abolitionists, and they said, we'll help you go back. And she went back. And as she was going back, she remembered a song that she had learned. It had to do with people coming out of Egypt. It went something like this.
When Israel was in Egypt land, let my people go. Oppressed so hard they could not stand, let my people go. Roll on, Moses, down in Egypt land, and you tell old Pharaoh, let my people go.
And she took that song to be her song. That song is speaking to me. I must be like a Moses. I've got to go back down and help my people to escape. And she went down, sneaked down the first time. She knew all the routes because her father told her about the forest. She knew how to get back. And she got back and she began to help people escape. She helped her brothers to escape. And she went back and got her parents. She helped them to escape. And then she went back again and she decided to help some more people escape. And she would say to the enslaved people, do you want to escape? Then follow me. But you've got to be very quiet. We're going to run at night and sleep and hide during the day. Run at night and sleep and hide during the day. And those babies, you've got to keep those babies quiet. Hold them to your breast. Don't smother them, but you've got to give them something to keep them quiet. We'll find a way. And they would go at night. They began looking up into the sky. Her father told her about the Big Dipper he had heard about. That points to the North Star. You follow that and you'll find your way. Not only that, as you begin to find your way, you begin to find something else, the Underground Railroad. The Underground Railroad was very several hiding places that people could go to. They could, maybe in the side of a board, they would put them in there and close the board, they would hide in there, or in a barn, or just in a bush, but they had to be very quiet. And so Harry would lead slaves out, and oftentimes, as he led them out, they're running. She would fall asleep. And the slave people would think, what's this? She's our leader, and she's falling asleep. We're supposed to follow her. We don't know where we're going. Should we continue going forward, or should we go backwards? And oftentimes, they thought they would go back. But as legend at least would have it, or the true story could really be, Harriet carried a gun in her skirt, or a rifle. And every time somebody started to go back, she woke up in time after her sleep. And she'd pull out that gun, or take that rifle, she pointed at them and say, you either go forward, or you're gonna stay right here. And she was going to shoot them. Because if they went back, they would be tortured. And they would tell where all the underground hiding places were on that Underground Railroad. She couldn't have that. The good news is, as I said last night even, is that Harriet never shot anybody. And she had a favorite saying. And the saying was, I never ran my train off the track, and I never lost a passenger. Harriet, who had escaped from Maryland, sometimes as far as Canada, went back 19 times and helped to 300 people, at least 300 people, to escape. Even if she went back to Maryland and escaped to New York 19 times, sometimes call your AAA and get the mileage on that. And she's walking and sometimes riding. All kind of things are being used. I want to send a message back to people that I'm coming. And they would begin to say when they heard this song, Moses coming. Tell old Pharaoh, who was the master, to let my people go.
They could have even had a song that we know, Swing Low, Sweet Chariot. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. I looked over Jordan, and what did I see? Coming for to carry me home, a band of angels coming after me. Coming for to carry me home. Here's what that song could have meant if it had been used. I don't know that it wasn't. I like to use it. Swing low. The abolitionists and other people are coming down from the north, coming down to the south. Sweet chariot. A chariot meant a wagon. A wagon was called a chariot. Coming for to carry me home. They couldn't go all the way home back to Africa, but they could go to a new home, and they could go way to a better home, would be Canada. Because if they went to Canada, they would surely be free, because the Canadian government told the American government, we will not send back anybody that escapes here because we do not believe in slavery. So that was a really good home, and that home would be called heaven. Coming for to carry me home, a band of angels. The band of angels would be white folks and black folks, abolitionists coming to help them to escape. All these secret words in the song. Coming after me, coming for to carry me home. And because they crossed so many different rivers, they would not want to name or call the names of the rivers. So each river was called the Jordan River, like the children of the Israelites crossing over the Jordan. I looked over Jordan, what did I see? Coming for the... But you see, the white masses never even thought about what they were singing. These are stupid people, they can't think. But here they were thinking all the time, and using these songs to help them escape. Coming after me, coming for to take me, carry me home. They'll say, if you want to escape, sometimes you older people, you can't run, you can't wade in the water, which meant to run in the water. We're gonna put you in a wagon. In a wagon? Well, how are we gonna know when a wagon gets here? When you hear this song, you know the wagon is here. There's a song about a wagon. And the wagon told the people, it's coming, don't miss it. You don't wanna miss it. You don't want the wagon to leave you behind. And the song said to the people when they heard it, get some young people to help you put in the wagon. In the wagon, to make a false bottom, put all kind of stuff on the top, put some older people in the bottom, and then take the wagon on to freedom. Harriet Tubman helped that to happen. And she went back 19 times to help the free people. And she did some strange things. One time, she went back, and just in case some of her masters might have seen her, she bought a couple of chickens. And she put the chickens, she tied the legs together, put the chickens around her neck, and started walking back into a town that she knew her masters might see it. Sure enough, the master's coming down the street. He saw this old woman with these chickens. She thought, oh boy, here they come. She took the chickens from around her neck, and she hit them and started saying, come back here, you chickens! Come back here, chickens! And the master said, look at that crazy old woman running after those chickens. And she was able to bring some more people to freedom. Please read about Harriet Tubman. A wonderful woman, a wonderful story. Dr. Carver. Dr. George Washington Carver. I am Dr. Carver. My name is George Washington Carver. I was a slave boy. And the best I can tell you is that my masters were good people. They treated me very nicely. And they were really concerned about me and my family. And the most important thing that they were concerned about was slave thieves. Something like horse robbers. They would come riding into the plantation at night, riding to the plantation, and they would steal as many slaves as they could and take them off someplace else and sell them. One night, as I understand it, My master heard these horses coming, and he knew right away that they were the slave robbers. And he said to my mammy, "You better get those boys, your children, get them hidden, because here they come." And my mammy, she wasn't fast enough. And so the slave robbers stole her. They even grabbed me. And they rode off. My master, as I understand it, was so unhappy that he lost her and me. He told somebody, "I want you to go and find my people that have been stolen. And if you find them, maybe you can have the young boy, maybe you can have George. I'll give you him for my people. I want you to get my people back." And that person just looked at me and, "I don't know about that." He said, "Well then, I'll give you my horse." He said, "Okay, I'll take the horse." In a sense, you might say I was traded for a horse. Well, they never found my mother, but they found me in the bush. I was so small and weak, they didn't think I could do any good, so they just left me behind until he found me, and my master gave him the horse. My master was a good master, as slave master can go. I started getting bigger and bigger. Not a very lonely child, but I loved to play with plants. I would take a plant, I would play with it, I would water it, I would take care of it, and I just a lot by myself, and I would make it grow. I got to be so good at that that my neighbors started calling me the plant doctor. And sometimes people come to my house and say, "We're having a problem with our plants. Can you help us?" Well, George can. A lady came to my house one day and said, "My roses won't grow." And she saw the roses around my master's house. And said, "Where'd you get those roses?" "Well, did you do that?" "No, George did that." "Well, do you think he would do something for me?" "Well, ask George. George, I have some roses. Would you help them to grow like those roses are growing?" I said, "Yes, sir. I'll help you. And I went over to her house, and first thing I noticed, she had the roses in the shade. And they weren't being watered very well. I said, "First thing, mammy, I take the roses out of the shade and put them out here, and then you begin to dig around and water them." And she did, and they grew, and they're just beautiful, like the roses I had at my house. Well, not only did it help her, but other farmers, I didn't care what the colors was. And they asked me to help them with the plants, I just went and helped them. And so I started helping them. I got to be a plant doctor. And it seemed to be that I was very smart. But you know, I was just very smart, you might call it today naturally, I guess you would call it, because they didn't allow me to go to school. My face was brown, so I couldn't go to school. But what I could do is get a chair and I'd go to the schoolhouse. And I sit next to the schoolhouse and I would listen to the lessons coming out of the windows. And I would listen to the teacher teaching the children coming out of the window. And then when they moved away from the window, I couldn't hear anything. I just sit there and wait. Then I heard them coming back, and I would listen to the window again and learn all that I could. But I loved playing with my plants. Well, I couldn't go to school. I said to my master, "I really want to go to the school. There's a colored school down there for colored children. Can I go to school?" He said, "George, you can't go to that school. That school is 12 miles away. That's too far for you to walk back and forth." I said, "But I want to go to school. I want to learn something." "George, you can't go to school." "Well, suppose I found a way to go to school. Would you let me go to school?" "George, if you find a way to go to school, we'll let you go to school." "Well, listen, would you give me a sandwich? Would you give me some water?" And I would just start down that road there, and I'll try to find a place to stay so I can go to school. "Okay, George, here's the water, here's the sandwich." And I started down that road. And I walked, and I walked, and I walked, and the sun was so hot, it was beaming down on my head. I drank that water, and I was so hungry, I ate that sandwich. And the sun was going down, it was getting dark. And now I knew I had to find a place to stay. It was getting dark. I continued to walk, and soon I saw a barn. The barn door was open. I looked around, I didn't see anybody. So I went to the barn door, peeped in, and I went inside. And I figured that I would wake up a long time before whoever owned the barn would wake up, and I would get out of it, and I would be gone. But I have to admit, I must have overslept. Because the next thing I heard was a woman came into the barn. She was screaming and shouting, "What are you doing here? What are you doing in this barn?" barn. And she ran out, she got her husband, and he came back and he was screaming and shouting at me, what am I doing in the barn? And I said, I wasn't trying to do no harm, sir. I'm just trying to go to school. I was just trying to find a way to go to school. Listen, if you just let me work on your farm, I would do anything you want me to do, just anything. But I would be closer to the college school, and I would like to go to that school. And they both looked at me, looked at one another, and I said, okay, you can work here. Fortunately for me, he happened to be a black farmer and a black and his black wife. And they let me stay there. And I worked there and I worked there and I worked there. And I went to this school. I went to the school and it seemed that I was so smart that eventually I was smarter than the teacher. But I always liked to work with plants. I always showed what to do with plants. Well, now it came time for me to graduate. And they said, I said, I want to go to college. You go to college? I want to go to college. They said, well, here's how you do it. If you want to go to college, you write a letter to the college, and they'll write back a letter to you accepting you. I wrote a letter to the college. I sent it off to the college. And the letter came back. It said, seems like you're a very smart person. We want you to come to our school. I got my bags packed. I started off to that college. I got to the college. I knocked on the door. They opened the door. What you want? I said, well, I want to go to your school. What do you mean go to my school? Well, I wrote you a letter. You wrote a letter back to me and said I could come to school. What's your name? My name is George Washington. Slam the door in my face. Couldn't go to that college. I went back and eventually I did find a college. It was a woman's college. They didn't teach what I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn about agriculture. They taught music and literature. I went to that college. I learned to play the piano. I learned to paint. But I still loved to deal with my flowers, and I still dealt with those flowers. Eventually, somebody heard about me, one of the women in the school, they heard that there's a man here that's learning, but he doesn't want to do this. He wants to learn about agriculture. Perhaps we can send him to another school. I'm glad they said that because I saw a lynching and I wanted to go to another school. So in a sense, ran away to Iowa. Fortunately, I was able to get into a school that did teach agriculture. And now, I was kind of smart. I mean, intelligent. I was so smart that I helped the professor when he talked about plants. And Ford heard about this. This man in the college here is so smart, he could help my car factory. I'll go down and ask him to work for me. Mr. Ford came and said, George, you're a real smart person. You helped the professor and everything. Why don't you come to work for me? He said, no, thank you. He said, George, I have a big company. I said, yes, sir. I guess you do. But I like to talk about plants. I don't want to work at a car factory doing things. George, you'd still be doing scientific. No, I want to work with plants. George, I'm going to build you a laboratory. Well, thank you, sir. Mr. Ford, Mr. Henry Ford, thank you. He built a fantastic laboratory. Had everything you want to have in a laboratory. I could do all kinds of things. With that laboratory, I was really happy. But I got a letter from a man named, let's see, Booker T. Washington. Booker T. Washington down there in Alabama and Tuskegee. And he wrote me a letter and said, George, we need you down here to teach our students. Won't you come down here and teach our students? I wrote a letter back to Mr. Booker T. and said, Mr. Booker T., do you have a laboratory down there? He said, we're building one. I said, Mr. Booker T., do you have any equipment down there? He said, we got some. I said, well then, Mr. Booker T., if you got those things, that's all I need. I'll come on down. I left a wonderful laboratory. I got down to Tuskegee, Alabama. I said, Mr. Booker T., where's your laboratory? He said, we're still building it. I said, where's your equipment? He said, there's a hole. And there's an old beat-up cow there you can use. Old Bessie, that cow on a swayback horse. I said, yeah. Do you have any students? He said, yeah, there's four or five people over there, young people over there. There's your students.
They looked like they didn't want anything to do with anything agriculture. They've been picking cotton a long time. So I just bent down and picked up the sand. It seems kind of dry, needs a little moisture. I said, okay, you students come with me. We got to build a laboratory. We're just going to go to the garbage dump. We're going to go to the garbage dump, and here's what I want you to find. I want you to find broken half bottles or tops, old inkwells. And we're going to use these things as Bunsen burners and things to mix our different chemicals in. We're going to build a laboratory. And they did that. And they started getting excited, even though they weren't in the beginning. And we built a laboratory out of this broken glass and broken tops and inkwells and just all kind of garbage junk. We cleaned it up and we started a laboratory. And I started working, started teaching them, and they started becoming very excited about it. I worked so hard at that laboratory that sometimes I just went in my room, I wouldn't even come out. The kids would bring food to me, set the food outside the door. They'd knock on the door, I wouldn't even open it. Because I was doing a couple of things in there when I wasn't teaching them. I was praying. I was praying to the Lord that He would show me how to make this ground fertile. I was praying to the Lord that He would give me guidance. And I couldn't come out and talk to anybody. They just left the food. When they left, I took the food and ate it and put the tray back out. And I just stayed in there. They got real worried about me. I was fine, but they got real worried about me. Well, I began to do it over and over and over again. Well, the ground started getting real good. Somebody would come and help me and say, our cotton is doing so good. I'd help them. But you know, we got another problem with the cotton. What's that? There's some little old black bug coming by and just eating up everything. You know that song? Oh, the boll weevil I am, a little black bug come from Mexico, they say. Come all the way to Texas, just looking for a home to stay, just looking for a home, just looking for a home. Well, that boll weevil came right through the south and started eating up all the cotton. What are we going to do about them? We're losing all our cotton, we're losing all our money. What can we do? I don't know what to do. There's some guy here named George Washington. Why don't we go and ask him what to do about the cotton? George? There's a boll weevil coming through here, eating up all the cotton. What are we going to do about the cotton? Broke penis. No, George, I said the boll weevil is coming through here and it's eating up all the cotton. What are we going to do about the cotton? Broke penis. No, you don't seem to understand. We're not interested in penis. We're interested in getting the boll weevil out of the cotton. The boll weevil don't eat penis. Grow penis. And so the state of Alabama started growing penis. And when one person grew them, everybody grew peanuts. Now, wait a minute. We don't have no cotton. We got all these peanuts. What are we going to do with these peanuts? I don't know. What can you do? We got to stop growing peanuts. Why don't we ask that George what to do with the peanuts? George, what are we going to do with these peanuts? I can come to your meeting and show you. I understand you're going to have a convention. I come to the meeting and show you what to do with those peanuts. Okay, George, when you come down to the meeting or wherever you're coming from, you have 5 minutes to tell us what to do with these peanuts. Okay. I put on my best suit and my best tie. I painted this tie myself. This tie is made out of vegetables and plants. And I painted it. Isn't that a beautiful tie?
Yes.
I like it. And I got my little bag with the samples and I took off to the meeting. I went down and I knocked on the door. Somebody opened the door and said, yeah, what you want? I said, my name is George Washington Carver. I'm here to talk to the investor about peanuts. Well, the meeting is not here. You go across the street. It's all across the street. But they told me the meeting was here. No, you go across the street. So I went across the street. I went to that door and I knocked on that door. Yeah, what you want? My name is George Washington Carver. I'm here to talk about peanuts. No, that convention across the street that we over there. Not here. When they told me it was here. No, it ain't here. It's back over there. I went back over there. You back again? Yes, I understand the meeting is here. Well,
It's here, but you can't come in here. I said, would you just give this note to the man that's running the meeting and tell him that George Washington Carver's out here. And I'll just wait out here. He slammed the door in my face and went away and came back. Yeah, they said, well, the meeting is here. You're supposed to be in here. I said, okay. No, you can't come in here. You got to go around the back. So I took my sample and I went up on around the back. I went upstairs. There they were, all in the meeting. Well, Georgia, I see you here. You got about 5 to 10 minutes to tell us what to do about peanuts. Well, if I only got 5 to 10 minutes, I think I'll just sit down and have some lunch. You want to have lunch? You got 5 or 10 minutes? Yeah, I'm going to have lunch. I open up this, eat some of that. Open up this one, ate some of that one too. That tastes pretty good. Open up this one, tastes good. So what you doing? I said, I'm having lunch. I only got 10 minutes. I might as well just have lunch. But what you eating? Well, why don't you try some? Well, what is it? Well, just try some. Well, here's some bread made out of peanuts. Here's some jelly made out of peanuts. Here's some fruit made out of peanuts. Here's some cookies made out of peanuts. Why don't you try some? George, this is real good. You know, rather than 15 minutes, you better stay a little while and tell us about it. I think I must have stayed about 3 hours. And they said, you know something? This stuff can be sold all over the world. We can make all kinds of things out of this stuff. I said, that's right. George, we're gonna have another convention. We're gonna have a bigger convention. We need to talk about this peanut. He said, well, that's very nice. I'll be glad to come. You can't come, George. What do you mean I can't come? You can't come because, you just come. They don't allow no colored people in the convention. He said, but I just showing you. Yeah, but George, you showed us. We're taking to show them. You can't come. All right. Fine. They went and showed the people how to use all those peanuts. State economy grew and grew and grew. And it was just beginning fine. But I couldn't participate in that. But still, when people came to me, I would still help them. Well, I died. George Washington Carver died. And anybody could help the whole world using peanuts. He invented many things using the peanuts, not just peanuts. It could be from shoe polish to pomade for your face, all kind of things. Please look it up, all the kind of things he invented using the peanut. When he died, George Washington Carver had $30,000 in the bank, which he gave to Tuskegee Institute. You know, and I know, that he should have been a millionaire 3 times over. This man helped the whole world with this kind of food. And I was so angry when I learned that this black man who did that thing, helped that state, helped and could help the world with all these products, only had $30,000. My anger was misplaced. George Washington Carver was the kind of person, this is really a love story, folks. George Washington Carver was the kind of person that if you or I asked him for help, he would give it. If you tried to pay him for it, he would not take your money. His idea was that God gave him the brains to know what to do, and all he can do is share it with you. He just worked for pay. That $30,000, he was the richest man in the world because of his love. And it was my mistake to become very angry with our system that didn't pay this man what he was worth. The story of George Washington Carver. Bill Pickett. Well, I'm going to have to tell you about Bill Pickett. I can't go through my usual antics. When I talk about Bill Pickett, I usually ride a horse. But it's usually when children are around. And you may not be young at heart for me to go and get my horse. But I got to do this for you. If one child around, I just got to do this. What I would do, you see there, Mary? I would get on my horse. I got to do this, I'm sorry. I would get on my horse. And I would ride in the plane. Yes. Well, Bill Pickett. When he was a little boy, about 14 years old, he was going down the road in his western town,
and he saw some cowboys trying to lasso some cattle out of the bush. They would throw the lasso in the bush, but the cattle were kind of smart. They were kind of just sort of ducked into the bush, and the ropes would go onto the bush. And they had a hard time getting those cattle out. But as he had been walking down the road, he noticed a farmer, a rancher, did it quite differently. He sent a bulldog into the bush after the cattle. The bulldog would jump up and bite the steer in the lip, and just the steer would just fall out. If someone bit you in the lip, you probably would fall over too, you know? So he saw that. When he was big and this part of his body was small down here, he saw that. And he went down the road again and he saw these cowboys and said, I bet you I get those steers out of there. Look, you boy, and then, because he was a boy, you boy, you can get those cattle out. Yep, I can do better than you. I challenge you to get those cattle out your way and my way. What in the world could you be talking about, boy? Well, just want to do it, or you don't want to do it. Yes, I'll do it. You throw your lassos, and I'll do it my way. They threw the lassos. Bill Pickett ran to the bush, jumped on the cow, grabbed it by the horn, and the steer grabbed by the horn and bent it back so he got the lip in his mouth. And he bit that lip and he let go and the cow just came right out. You know, like I said, you come out too, somebody bit you in the lip. And so he started doing that. And he became very popular doing that. He became part of a rodeo working for the 101 Ranch. And that was his forte. Getting cattle, getting steer to come out. And he would grab it. And then he would bite it and let go and dig his heels in, and he would just roll on with him, follow wherever he wanted to go. He was doing such a good job. His owner, his boss, I guess we would say, not his owner, he wasn't a slave. Almost treated like one, but anyway, he wasn't a slave. We're gonna take you to Mexico. We're gonna challenge the toreadors with their bull. We're gonna bet money on you to like 1,500 pesos. You go to Mexico. Bill Pickett had never seen a bull. So they go to go to Mexico, and he says, you have 7 minutes to throw this bull, doing it your way. Well, Spadley, the horse, his horse, they rode out after the bull. And they rode out after the bull. No, Spadley wanted to go this way, but he made Spadley come back towards that bull, and he jumped off on that bull and supposed to grab it and pull it. And pull it head back, and so he gets it, bite his lip. But the neck on a bull is about that thick. You know, you got about probably a 5,000-pound animal, look like. He's trying to pull it back. He has 7 minutes, and he's pulling, he can't get it back. And time is going on, and nobody's helping him. And he only has to stay there 7 minutes. Six and a half, 6 3/4, 7 minutes passed, and he's still trying to fight this bull, and he's getting tired. He's about to fall off the bull, but he falls off, the bull will trample him, and nobody is trying to help him. And the toreador certainly wanted him to get killed. This gringo coming to their country to disparage what their sport, and he's pulling. It's almost 10 minutes ago now. He's still holding, but he has to hold, because if he falls off, he's going to be killed for sure. But he's getting weak all the time, and soon, probably just before he got ready to fall, if he couldn't hold it anymore, his two cowboy friends said, you know, we better go out and help him, because nobody's going to help him at all. If he falls off that bull, he's going to be killed. And so these two guys ride out. They ride out and they pull him off and they distract the bull. The two riders that came out to help him became very famous movie stars, Tom Mix and Will Rogers. Isn't that something? Tom Mix and Will Rogers, they were the two that helped him. Well, Bill eventually died because as he got older, he still was around horses, but he misjudged what he was doing to the horse kicked him in the head and it killed him. But he is the only black person in the Hall of Fame for the rodeo people at that time. Bill Pickett, that's a good name. So we were kind of all over the place. I wanted to get to this Tuskegee Airmen. You've all heard about the Tuskegee Airmen, haven't you? Who has not heard about Tuskegee Airmen? I maybe shouldn't put it that way. I don't know. Maybe it's, oh no. The Tuskegee Airmen was an experiment. One day I want to write a book called The Afterthought. The Afterthought has to do with calling up black people to fill in the vacant spaces. I don't care if it was the Civil War, or the Revolutionary War, all the wars black people are always held behind. We don't read about black people being involved in these things. But they were called up when they needed more manpower. When they needed to save the day, black people were called up. It didn't make them special, just that they were left out until the end of something. That's what happened to the Tuskegee Airmen. The Tuskegee Airmen were black a group of civilian people that wanted to be flyers. They wanted to fight for our country. No, you can't fly a plane. You're black. You can't fly a plane. You don't have any intelligence, which is not true. We all know that. But because so many people are asking, we're going, and NAACP and Urban League is fighting the government, we're going to put a school down here in Tuskegee, Alabama, and we're going to send some people down there that want to fly, but they have to stay down there. Okay, so they send them down there. They begin to teach the people. I think it takes about 3 months to train a pilot during the wartime, especially the Second World War. They began training these people, and they trained them for 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, 6 months. I'm not sure they didn't train it for 9 months. Not that they needed that much time, but because after the 3 month period, they were going to have little gold bars on their shoulder. That meant white people would have to salute black people. And they couldn't have that and did not know what to do with these airmen when they trained them. So they, in a sense, were keeping them out of the war. They continued to train them. They must have been the best trained people in the world. They just trained them and trained them and trained them. The only thing that changed that, as the story goes, as I've read somewhere, I don't remember, I read all these things anymore. One day, Eleanor Roosevelt came down, the president's wife came down, and she says, commanding officer of this base here, Tuskegee Training School, I want to take a ride up in one of the airplanes. Oh, yes, ma'am, you white major, you take the president's wife up. Wait a minute, why the white major? Well, all these men are trained, aren't they? Yes, they're trained. Is something wrong with their flying? No, ma'am. Well, why can't I fly with them? Okay, you... airman take the president's wife up for a ride. He takes her up and flies around, and they land. When they land, the president's wife says, you know, what I don't understand is, our boys, and everybody was called boys at that time, no matter what you were, our boys are over there fighting, and these boys over here still training. Why is that? I'm going to ask the president. When she got back to Washington, D.C., and asked the president, apparently he said, and they were gone in 1 week. They were gone in 1 week, and they went to Italy. But even though they were there, even though they were still overseas, they were flying in this zone over here, which like a milk run is, fly back and forth, back and forth, and back. You're not doing anything. You're not really in a war. This is a white man's war. They're flying back and forth. Over there, white bomber crews from our country are flying, trying to bomb something, and they need an escort over here. And they're flying along, and the escort is running out of fuel, has to go back. And they're saying, we're getting ready to run into some enemy aircraft. Where is our escort? But they had to go back, because they're running out of fuel. These guys are flying over here doing nothing. They hear the guys over here saying, we don't have an escort. These guys say, hey, those are our guys. They don't have any body to help them fight off those Luftwaffe and whatever other planes they have coming over. We're gonna go over and help them. Wait, that's not what we're supposed to do. I don't care what we're supposed to do. Those are our guys. We're gonna go over and help them. And so they go over and help them. And they shoot down all of the enemy planes. They lose not a single bomber, never lost a bomber during the wartime. They had these red tails on the airplanes. And so when they flew over there, all the bomber crew could see were these red tails going on, shooting down everybody, all the enemies. And so when they were safe, the guys flew back and did their routine thing and then landed. The bomber crew was so amazed at this. When they landed, they wanted to go and find out who in the world were those guys with the red tails. Those red tail aircraft, they'd never seen them before. They were P-51 aircraft. Red tail aircraft. They landed. They got in cars and jeeps and tried to find these guys. As they came into this particular base, they saw men with brown faces in pilot's clothing. The goggles, the parachutes, the uniforms, the boots, the everything that says
this guy is a pilot. They drive up to the man and say, we're looking for the guys that fly those red-tailed airplanes. He said, that's us. No, no, not you. We're looking for the guys that fly the red-tailed airplanes, you know. They really saved our lives. We want to, you know, thank him. He said, that's us. That's you? They turned around and drove away. Did not thank them. The good news of the story is, though, when it came time to fly over Germany for the big mass movement, the white crews are being briefed, the colonels are briefing all of them, where they're going to bomb, what they're going to do. And okay, everybody got that? Yes. Okay, take off time at 0600. There you go. You can leave now. Oh, wait a minute. Colonel, I have one question. What is your question, Captain? The guys that fly the red-tailed airplanes, are they going to be there? Well, they've not been invited in. They've not lost a bomber to enemy fire. They've not been invited. Colonel, I want to see these guys there with me when I go. And can you imagine having to have a fight like that about people that were so great in their flying that they could save our crews? They had to ask for them too. The Red Tail Angel, an experiment in bringing a black person in our country. Many experiences have happened like that, in the Navy too. They had a whole ship in the Navy commanded by white officers and seamen, commanding black people on this ship, an experiment. Crazy country. However, I want to end this program like I ended one yesterday. I think that the most important thing about our country today is that whatever has happened in the past, we are now sending people, whatever the color, that they qualify, to outer space in spaceships and command modules. So we're getting someplace, but we here on the ground still have a way to go. This program, Bring Them Back to Life, has a lot of things to do. Paul Robeson was a man that was called a communist. He was never proven to be a communist. Paul Robeson, one of my favorite people, one of the greatest voices in the world, one of the greatest American citizens in the world. Paul Robeson was just doing what our forefathers did when they established the country. He was doing the same thing. I think his problem, you might call it that, was that he did it. He spoke against our country as he stood on the shores of another country. I'm a communist country. And he supported many communist things. But in my opinion, it's not written this way, but in my opinion, Paul Robeson was a great football star. Did you know that? He was an All-American twice, maybe three times. Paul Robeson was a valedictorian of his graduating class in college. Paul Robeson was a highly intelligent person. He could speak 21 languages, or he could sing 21 languages anyway, and speak at least five or six of them. He was a highly intelligent person. Paul Robeson was a lawyer. Paul Robeson was a lawyer. He was one of the, he would talk about a Renaissance man. He was that. He was a great man. And he was a great team player. This is my opinion now, his team part. And I think that Paul tried to find a team that he could play on, in a sense, that could play against the greatest team in the world, the United States of America, as they treated black people very poorly. But he went from just concerning himself with black people being treated poorly to people all over the world who were being treated poorly. He was an American, he was an American citizen, and certainly a world citizen. His passport was taken from him. The only American to have a passport taken and be restricted from traveling to Canada, where you don't need a passport, or Mexico, where you don't need a passport. No other American has had that happen to him. And you all probably remember the McCarthy era. That ruined Paul's career. And you know that McCarthy eventually was really chastised for his actions. But he ruined the lives of a lot of people. But please read about Paul Robeson. Please read about some of these other people. There's so many people to read about. I can't share more with you. I just don't have the kind of time I wish you did. Anyway, that's the program. Thank you very much for your time.